Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
And welcome, Earth Explorers. From all over the planet, on planet, off planet, you are welcome here. Solar wind, nice and mild, a very few sunspots out there to worry about. Solar flares, not really a worry, and occasional prominence here and there. We do have some cosmic news, though. We have been doing a lot of research on Elenin. We were going to bring you a little bit of that update. It isn't quite ready yet. The reason it's not ready is because nobody can find out anything about it. So if any of our listeners out there have an update on Elenin and you can bring that to us, you can do that by calling in the program. We'll leave the phone lines open all night. There is also an asteroid which is going to make its way along around the same time frame. We have a September time frame for Elenin. We have a November time frame, early November, November 8th, 9th, for this asteroid, which is known as YU-56. Now, this is kind of a peculiar thing. You could do a little bit of research on your own, but you're only going to find the stuff from JPL. And one of the things you're going to find strange about this is that the trajectory, when you look at the plot, is absolutely straight, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because if you look at the size of this asteroid, which is certainly way, way smaller than our moon, the gravitational pull of Earth and the moon as it's going to pass within a lunar distance of both of them should be pulling on that trajectory. It should curve a little bit. There's a little bit of gravitational perturbation that should take place there. It's not showing up in the path. And as we've often stated on this program, the fly hits the 747 with just as much force as the 747 hits the fly. In other words, Earth is going to tug on that asteroid, and the asteroid is going to tug on Earth and the moon. Certainly could have a more dramatic effect on the orbit of the moon than it could the Earth. The interesting thing about the moon is, you know, that it revolves on its axis at exactly the same rate with which it revolves around Earth, which means the same side of the moon always faces us. It is assumed, at least based upon all of the research and documentation we know about the moon, that the far side of the moon, that is to say that the side of the moon that faces away from the Earth, is heavier than the side that faces toward Earth. And that may be one reason why it revolves the way that it does. It's just lopsided, and it's settled in a way where the heavy side is facing away from the Earth. If another gravitational body comes in and pulls on that heavy side of the moon, or upsets that 1 degree wobble that the moon has back and forth, we could see a little bit more of the moon than we've ever seen before. In any case, these are going to be remarkable cosmological times, and you want to keep your eyes skyward and your ears tuned to X Squared Radio. This is where you come to get squared. On the weather, we have seen some very extreme weather of late. Unbelievably hot temperatures in the northern hemisphere and unbelievably cold temperatures in the southern hemisphere. It is really quite something to see this occurring right before our eyes. It isn't that the average temperature of the Earth is changing so much. It's that the extremes, the very cold, the very hot, are really having their effect. And it is strange times to live in, to be sure. couple of announcements. We have next weekend, the 15th through the 17th, actually the 16th, I will be speaking at the MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network meeting in Phoenix. So if you want to, if you're in the area and within driving distance or cheap flying distance, you may want to make your way over there to MUFON. We're going to give a full-length presentation on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. So those of you listening to this program, if you're close to Phoenix, find your way to the MUFON Phoenix chapter and get yourself over there. It could be a very affordable way for you to see this presentation live. It's quite something. On another note, a good announcement for the Pythagoras Conference. Those of you that are keeping up with it, the Pythagoras Conference is really the first conference of its kind in Louisville. Louisville, Kentucky, as you know, is at the epicenter of well over 70% of the population of the country. And that makes it within driving distance, which greatly lowers the cost to attend a conference. And that's part of the announcement as well. The price has been lowered. Management has looked at the event and decided that the quality of it is better than you're going to see just about anywhere in the country. 20 top quality, world-class, world-renowned presenters for a price of $399. That is really unprecedented, and it's even more unprecedented than it that it's in the Midwest. We don't really see conferences of this quality unless you want to go to the West Coast. Most of you are not going to fly to the West Coast to see such a conference. So this is a great new beginning for the Midwest. Louisville, Kentucky is very accessible for all of you. And I think you should come. It's December 21st this year in Louisville. It's a little bit close to Christmas, but most of you are going to be done with your shopping anyway, right? And you're really concerned about the events that are coming up in the next year. This is really the conference to see. Sandra Sabatini and her group have really put together what I think is a world-class conference, indefinitely a world-class venue, the Galt House. Yeah, the Galt House, right on the river in Louisville. First-class venue with world-class speakers for a record-breaking price, and I think you should make your way there to see it, December. Check it out by going to xsquaredradio.com. Click on the Pythagoras Conference banner. The reason I want you to do it that way is I get special credit when you do that. You get a great discount, and it's a great place to be, the Pythagoras Conference, December 2011. Could be an annual thing. Definitely think we're going to make it that way. And if you'll go there and check it out, you'll see the quality of the speakers that are coming in, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Tonight, we're coming to you from southern Mississippi, right down near the Gulf Coast. Yes, it is unbearably hot. Mix with the unbearably heat, 100 plus, add 100 plus humidity, water actually fell out of the sky a few moments ago and bounced off of the incinerator hot asphalt and re-evaporated right back into the air. If you can imagine what that's like. If you've been to a steam room lately, you'll understand what I'm talking about. My Scottish frame is not made for such things, but that's what we're weathering. You can join us tonight, all 3 hours, by calling in at 530-413-4511 if you're off-planet. Nice and calm out there, with the exception of a little bit of space junk. Our brethren in the International Space Station had to huddle in the escape pods earlier this week because some space junk had been spotted very close, within just a couple hundred feet of the ISS. And they really didn't want to be in the big airframe should any kind of collision happen. So they all got into the escape pods, closed the door, and said their prayers in hopes that they did not have to re-enter Earth's atmosphere in that little thing. But once the space junk went by, they crawled out and got back to business. So if you're off-planet, you can reach us at 530-413-4511. I had somebody ask me the other day, what is west of Earth and east of Earth? Obviously a listener, but not an Earth explorer. If you're west of Earth, you can call at 530-413-4515. And if you're east of Earth, 530-413-4520. No, I didn't say left and right. That's not that way at all. That's not what that means. It's just a thinking process, west of Earth, east of Earth. You can also join us by listening on your cell phone, 712-432-0075. And put in the passcode 318116#. And that number may have been updated. I'll get the studio to write me here and see if that number is current. I believe it is, but if it isn't, we'll announce the number, and then you can get out, walk around, go to the store, walk around and look at the people at Walmart, and still be able to listen to the program. You won't be able to call in unless you dial the number, but you'll be able to listen to the whole program. Tonight we were going to have Jim Stone on the program. Jim Stone is, for all intents and purposes, an investigative reporter, and he's done a phenomenal job, and I mean way beyond phenomenal, putting together a special report that literally rocked the world a couple of weeks ago. By the way, I do have the updated number. It is 760-569-7676. That's 760-569-7676. And the passcode is 630931#. 630931. And if you want to call in toll-free, we have not had a toll-free number prior to this, or at least for a long time. As you know, the folks at PBS Radio in Paradise, California, which is 40 miles south of heaven, have been continually upgrading the hardware. That's why the sound quality is so good. That's why PBS Radio is the number one internet talk radio network on the web anywhere on Earth. You're listening to it right now. By the way, if you want to be part of that, I'll let you know how to do that in a minute. The toll-free number is 888-260-3070. 888-260-3070. And it's good anywhere in North America. You want to call that number, it's toll-free. You don't have to worry about anything but your cell phone minutes. If you feel like you want to try your hand at being a talk radio host, please get a hold of me here at X Squared Radio, bagnew@x2-radio.com. I would be most happy to get you sponsored into a BBS Radio's network, get you a slot, help you build your audience. And we'll see if you have what it takes to sit behind the cardioid mic and let your voice be heard. Several of the hosts that are on the BBS Radio Network came there this way. So if you're out there listening and you think you've got a great idea, you want to enlighten people, you want to enrage people, although I would prefer the former, you can do so on the BBS Radio Network. Get a hold of me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I'll let you know how to do that. Jim Stone released an article, and then was interviewed on Janik's Feet to Fire. Excellent network, by the way. Janik does a great job. Been on his program. He does a great job of making sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed on various subjects. And what was released to the world, many of you may know already because you are Earth explorers and are listening to all the greatest news out there, because there is the mainstream news, which is the mainstream, you know, it's the big river. It's the one that's carrying all the dead stuff out to sea, the stuff that doesn't swim, you know, the floaters, the mainstream. They're not like you and me, we're swimmers in the mainstream. Yeah, we listen, but hey, we don't float, we swim. And we're swimming upstream right now because it doesn't cut it with me, the mainstream. Then the cable channel news, there's a tributary to the mainstream. Yeah, you get pretty much a scripted news from them. They send out the facts to everybody. They got the same talking points, and some are left and some are really left, and some are claiming to be fair and balanced. It's a little better than mainstream, but it's still all part of the same cesspool. Then you have online news, you got Drudge Report, you have Newsmax, which is very difficult to follow and to believe, because most of the writers, most of the staff writers on there are very, very slanted, right? So you're not going to get a really fair and open discussion of the facts. Drudge Report at least will do their research, put the links on there. They change them up throughout the day, several times an hour. So if you cruise the Drudge Report, believe me, it's at the headwaters of most of the quasi-mainstream news out there. I would highly recommend it to check it out. Do so with an open mind and a guarded pocketbook, because there's a lot of junk going on out there. However, if you want to get out of the mainstream, dry off a little bit and figure out what's going on and really assess your knowledge base, then you need to be here at the BBS Radio Network. All kinds of hosts talking about all kinds of subjects. And here at X Squared Radio, we try to do so with a positive slant, but nevertheless investigative. And we discover and discuss all kinds of science here. Biology, chemistry, physics, cosmology, mathematics, and even political science from time to time. And today, because it is July 3rd, which is the day before we celebrate Independence Day, independence from British rule, like that ever ended, I thought it would be appropriate to cover this political subject, this political science subject. Because Jim, and by the way, his website is Jim Stone Freelance, like freelancewriter.com, jimstonefreelance.com. If you are a newsletter subscriber, X Squared Radio ARC newsletter, then you got an alert that this program was going to happen tonight. If you are a BBS Radio regular and you are part of their newsletter program, there was an alert sent out announcing this program tonight, and you should be sitting there with your fingernails ready to dig into the desk, because this subject could be, very well could be, the precursor to the events that really do change this world. There are, as you know, from time to time, disasters. Some of them are natural disasters like hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, tsunamis. And some are man-made, like oil spills, weather, earthquakes, tsunamis. How can you tell the difference? That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because that's one of the things we're going to cover tonight. As Jim pointed out, there is some amazing evidence out there that the most recent terrible earthquake that we had on the planet, that is affecting every living thing on this planet with I was going to use the word deadly radiation, and then I thought, no, maybe it's just radiation. And then I reconsidered, no, it is deadly radiation. Just some quick calculations. You know, it would only take a little over 300 nuclear devices exploded in the atmosphere to put enough radioactive material in the air to kill every living thing on the Earth. Really, enough. It would put enough plutonium in the air. It's so poisonous that it would literally kill every living thing on the planet, all the way down to bacteria, except for cockroaches. They would survive. The release of radioactivity from the Fukushima site has come close to that amount. Now, it didn't happen overnight. It is what we call a slow leak. It is creating a chronic exposure, not an acute exposure. Many experts in my field, nuclear chemistry, including those that are not experts in nuclear chemistry but are physicists who know a lot about radioactivity, are now saying that the exposure to low levels of radiation, which are several times higher than background, can be just as devastating to the race as a single acute exposure. Why is that? Because the half-life for this material is relatively short compared to plutonium. And that means that the incidence of collision, the alpha collision, that's a large nuclear radioactive particle of various frequencies, depends on what it comes from and what it attaches to in the human body. That alpha decay destroys tissue. Now, usually we use it in oncology. I don't say we as though I am part of oncology, but the oncological field uses it to treat cancer, because cancer tissue, as a rule, is more dense than healthy tissue. And so, statistically speaking, it's a little like shooting a golf ball at chicken wire instead of a chain link fence. The chain link fence being healthy tissue and chicken wire being cancerous tissue. The odds of the particle hitting the chicken wire are much higher. And so the radioactive treatment that you receive with the activated drugs, chemotherapy that they use in the treatment of cancer, is successful because the radioactive decay kills the cancerous cell before it kills the healthy tissue. That's how it works. That being said, just about everybody that I know, with the exception of a few politicians, has a spine and has bones in their body, which are, as you know, the most dense part of a human body. And yes, indeed, when the radioactive material strikes those bones, you have an incident of collision. That's how X-rays work. Your bones absorb the radiation. The radiation goes right through the rest of your tissues, which exposes the film. So that's how X-rays work. And unfortunately for most vertebrates on the planet, the radioactivity that's being released into the atmosphere by Fukushima is not of the type that will just harmlessly go away once it's absorbed in your bones. When it decays, it's going to kill localized tissue, which, as you know, in the center of your bones is bone marrow, and the marrow is responsible for making blood cells. And that means that induced leukemia is likely. And in fact, in every single case where there has been a nuclear accident, there has been a subsequent rise, significant rise, in leukemia. If you go to several websites which are tracking this nuclear cloud as it goes around the planet, you'll see that there is almost no place in the Northern Hemisphere that is not affected by this cloud. One of my associates rented a nuclear detector a few weeks ago and just went around his house just checking things just to make sure. And he lives in Florida, by the way. And, well, he detected higher than background radiation in his toilet. I don't know what that means, So if you call me and ask me why the toilet, I don't know. It could be the ceramic in the toilet. Not likely that it's the water, but it could be. Now, I mentioned that earthquakes, tsunamis, and weather can be man-made. You know and I know that we do have weapons systems on the earth that can manipulate these things. We've known since Secretary of State Cohen said in 1996 that weather could be manipulated by weapons like HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. And it is so well known that the United States agreed to draft and sign a treaty agreeing not to use HARP to manipulate the weather. And maybe we're obeying the treaty. Some out there have called me and written me and asked me if HARP was involved in triggering the quake in Japan. I said, honestly, I really don't know. I don't have any proof. I can't find a radio marker. I can't find evidence of a violet sky before it happened. I tried to follow the money to see if the United States would even be involved in trying to induce a quake off the coast of Japan, and I could not connect the dots. Just not enough evidence, just not credible enough. I, some weeks ago, tried to connect the dots and say, well, if HARP was used, then it wasn't the U.S. HARP. Maybe it was another HARP. Maybe it was one in China. Maybe it was one in Australia. Maybe it was the one in Russia. Let's follow the money and see what happens. Well, as it turns out, just a few months before this quake occurred on March 11th, 3/11/2011, China announced very quietly and then began to act immediately, and we didn't learn until just recently that this was completed. It began dumping 97% of its ownership in short-term U.S. debt, otherwise known as treasury bills. This is devastating to the mortgagee. The mortgage holder is selling off the note, and buyers have to be ready to buy it to recapitalize China for that debt. The mortgagee, which is us, the United States, making interest payments on that debt, obviously China was making money off of. And a lot of money, not just a little bit. I mean, the interest on this amount of debt, pretty close to $1 trillion, is no small amount of money. That's a steady income stream. Some ask, why in the world would China do such a thing? Why would they sell off their debt? Well, we went to the news media and we played for you clips where it didn't make a whole lot of sense until we discovered that the United States had sold weapons, a lot of them, to Taiwan off mainland China. This is very typical empire building for the United States. We often feed weapons to the enemies of our enemies, although the Taiwanese are very good traders with the United States, very high-tech, very computer-progressive society, wanting to stay free, wanting to not be part of mainland China. Of course, they are greatly outnumbered by mainland China, so there's no doubt whatsoever who runs the show. But Taiwan is kind of overlooked for now because they're doing so well from a capitalistic standpoint. That being said, China did not want weapons sold to Taiwan, which is what we did. So China cut off its nose despite its face and sold off the debt. We don't need the interest that badly, they said. And they sold off the debt. Now, China is the number one owner of American debt. The number two owner, Japan. Japan, the number two owner, Europe, number three. Well, interestingly enough, as just about the time the Chinese were announcing that they were going to sell off their ownership in short-term U.S. Treasury notes, Japan made an announcement of their own. I'm going to play for you a little news clip because this news item went largely unnoticed by the mainstream press. Some picked it up, some did. But I'm telling you, this was so earth-shaking. I really had to search to find the right clip. The clip begins with Netanyahu behind a microphone. He's not speaking, but his statement is about to come out. I want you to listen very closely. Here we go. Listen up.
As Israel's prime minister keeps up the pressure for effective and biting sanctions against Iran, a new proposal is being floated. Japan has offered to process uranium for Iran to be used for civilian purposes. The idea is up for discussion as Iran's parliament speaker, Ali Larijani, begins a five-day visit to Tokyo.
For Japan, this offers a way to potentially defuse the Iranian nuclear crisis. And in doing so, that would give Japan the opportunity of avoiding the disruption to their energy supplies coming from the Middle East.
Welcome to Dispatch. I'm Marla Dial. Foreign offers to enrich and process nuclear fuel for Iran are meant to allay concerns that uranium would be used to build nuclear weapons. France and Russia have made offers of their own already, only to be rejected by Iran. But Japan's offer might be considered differently.
Japan stands in here in a very unique way. One, Japan is a U.S. ally, but at the same time, Japan has a somewhat independent foreign policy. It's not necessarily seen as a tool of the United States. Two, Japan doesn't really have an active foreign military presence because of their constitutional issues. And the third, the Japanese are kind of an honest broker in this situation, since they've already been the recipients of nuclear weapons.
Japan has reasons of its own to step into the nuclear controversy. For one thing, Iran is its third largest oil supplier, and neither the Japanese economy nor the world's could easily absorb the hit to energy supplies. Meanwhile, Japan is also waging a battle for influence against China, its much larger regional rival.
Japan has really seen its international clout wane during its basically 20 years of economic malaise, and they're looking to find a way to reassert themselves on the world stage, and this would provide them a very unique opportunity to do so.
But can this proposal move forward in diplomatic channels?
The deal itself is really in an early stage. It's not really a deal. It's more of an idea. I think the United States would have to go along with it, and they might because the United States does not look really anxious to put down sanctions or go to war. The Iranians would really have to agree to it, and a lot of that depends upon how much pressure is on Iran, and that's going to come down to where Russia votes on sanctions.
All right. That is Stratfor, Global Intelligence, at stratfor.com. You can check out their website. Very credible reporters. This is a very credible story. So about the time that China announces that it's going to divest itself of U.S. treasuries, Japan makes the announcement that they are going to enrich uranium for Iran. Where is this going to occur? Ooh, I'm glad you asked that question, but I'm going to give you the answer a little bit later. One of the things that we find interesting as the tensions rise in the Middle East is that there are many cameras watching every square centimeter of ground over there. Nothing can move, no money can move, no radio transmissions, not even a foot courier can walk across the borders over there without being noticed. Nevertheless, Israel has made very vocal, as you heard that Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu was vehemently against Japan selling enriched uranium to Iran because of its suspicion that Iran was going to use this enriched uranium not for power generation but for weapons construction. Israel could do nothing about Iran, but they could do something about Japan. One of the things that we read about last year that was ostensibly released upon Iran by agents of Israel was a virus called the Stuxnet virus. We know what the Stuxnet virus was designed for. It was designed to upset the communications of internal equipment that was being controlled by Siemens hardware and software at nuclear facilities. Siemens, as you may be aware or may not be aware, makes all kinds of electrical power distribution and control software. It is generally called SCADA. This is Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Software, of which on which nuclear power plants rely for communication between all kinds of temperature transducers, flow indicators, microswitches, different kinds of temperature sensing and pressure sensing devices. They feed it to a software control program which controls valves and pumps and vents and things like that to make nuclear power plants very safe. Once you interrupt the communication or corrupt the communication between these devices, the plant becomes uncontrollable. That Stuxnet virus was released on Iran. It made international news. Iran immediately accused Israel, who threw its hands up and said, "We have no idea what you're talking about." That virus proliferates very easily. It's actually stored on thumb drives and can easily be moved from frame to frame without any problem. So this is the mystery. You have this amazingly effective virus that is designed to function very well on Siemens hardware and software, and you have nuclear power plants built in Japan by a joint effort between GE and Toshiba. And they run on Siemens hardware and software. And sure enough, as luck would have it, this Stuxnet virus made its way to Japan. And it was announced that the Stuxnet virus was discovered. Some denials happened. But nevertheless, it was present. Item number two is that the uranium was going to be enriched in a plant just south of Fukushima. This plant had been offline for a number of years. Japan had gained some money to be able to reopen this plant. There was some bad press. Locally, they tried to stop it. Several people filed lawsuits. The lawsuits were finally defeated. And the plant was started back up again with a specific task of enriching uranium for the specific market of being able to sell to Iran, which Iran, as you know, was feeding, as you just heard in this piece, feeding a lot of oil to Japan. And so... the connection gets deeper and deeper. Now, here are the pieces that Jim put together. And this is really the crux of tonight's program. Here are the facts as they came in. When the quake occurred, there were many claims that this was an 8.9 quake, that it was a 9.1 quake. It was really a spectacular report. However, what Jim pulled up was a series of photographs, and you've seen them too. Some of them are still shots from video, and some of them are actual surveillance camera shots of the tsunami as it hit Japan. Now, as you know, the quake happened first. And some minutes later, the tsunami happened. I watched it along with everyone else on the news, just as you did. The interesting thing is that what I noticed when I was watching the video is the absence of people. I thought, oh my goodness, this tsunami is crashing in on an uninhabited town. There was no cars driving out of the way. There were no people out in the streets. There was no mayhem that should have been present after an earthquake. I mean, in this country, you know, people run for their lives if there was an earthquake like that. The other thing that Jim noticed, and this was an incredibly astute observation, as he looked at the photographs, he noticed that there was no damage to any of the buildings. Even the wooden houses and apartments were still standing. None of the elevated buildings were toppled. No glass was broken. No cars were out of line. No roads cracked open. Well, I went back to two quakes that had occurred in Japan, devastating quakes, one in 1995, one in 1923. I looked at the photographs from that quake, and I found that the damage was devastating. The quake that happened in 1995, these were modern buildings built to withstand earthquakes. Hey, when you get a quake of about 7.5, 7.0, this one that happened in Kobe was a 6.5, stuff falls down. No matter how well it's built, it's going to fall down. Some things are going to break. Fascia is going to break off of buildings. Glass is going to break. Roads are going to crack open. Telephone poles are going to fall over. Trees are going to go out of line. Gas mains are going to break. Water mains are going to break. Fires are going to start. None of this was present in Fukushima. None. Not a broken glass, not a toppled car, not a cracked street, nothing. This quake, if it was an 8.6, which would have been about 300 times more powerful than the one in Kobe, would have flattened some of these buildings. Oh, there's more. Video was taken. Surveillance video inside office buildings in Fukushima. The video got out on the web. Jim found it. While the quake is going on inside the office structure, a few books fall off the table, a couple things fall off of bookshelves, but the three or four people in the video are largely unaffected. Oh, another earthquake, they say. Gee, I better hold on to something. One of the guys sits in his roll-around office chair and keeps right on typing on the keyboard like he was emailing somebody. Hey, we're going through a quake right now. It's pretty cool. This was no 8.6. This wasn't even a 6.6. So somebody had to do a little digging and see if they could find the USGS scans, and that's exactly what Jim did, and what he publishes on his website are the actual USGS charts of that quake, and guess what? 5.6. That's consistent with the photographs. That's consistent with the video right before the tsunami hits. So let's connect the dots here as we wrap up this first hour. Japan offers to enrich uranium for Israel. Israel makes a public statement saying that's really not a good idea. Immediately, Israel sets up front companies masquerading as security companies, and one of them succeeds in getting a security contract at the Fukushima nuclear facility. 4 months later, a quake happens. Now, the quake was probably not caused by anything. They didn't need to induce a quake. Quakes happen all the time. They knew it was only a matter of time before a quake would happen. And when the quake was happened, it was helped out a little bit. Because one of the things that you notice when you watch the news is that reactor number 4 exploded. Well, that is consistent, isn't it? Sure. I mean, if a reactor overheats, it builds up hydrogen gas. Hydrogen gas floats to the top of the containment. Sooner or later, a spark is going to happen. The hydrogen ignites. You get a nice explosion. Well, something's not right here. Because reactors are supposed to have a 15-foot thick reinforced concrete with steel rebar in it to withstand a hydrogen explosion just for that reason. And guess what? Most reactors have that. All the GE/Toshiba reactors have them, except for reactor number 4. That containment had been removed because that reactor was undergoing work. And what's worse, what makes the news even more unbelievable, is that there was no fuel in this reactor. It had been defueled 4 months before. There was nothing to explode in this reactor. Now, the other thing is, even if it was fueled, even if it did have its containment in place, even if the hydrogen explosion did take place, the explosion wasn't consistent with that, but it was consistent with something else. Some months before, photographs of a clandestine, I'm not going to call this an improvised explosive device. This is a well-designed explosive device. It's a small nuclear device that can be placed in a certain area and detonated. You can see the blast pattern for yourself, the smoke, the cloud, the blast pattern, everything on the web. It's there. You can go to the website and look at it for yourself. I'm not making any of this up. And then you can look at the blast pattern that happened at reactor number 4 in Fukushima. Guess what? Aha, that's right. They're identical. They are identical. Not consistent with a hydrogen explosion, but very consistent with this clandestine tactical nuclear explosion. How in the world did they get this weapon into the Fukushima nuclear site? I'm glad you asked that question. As it turns out, the weapon is designed by Israel. And it looks exactly like a camera, which is also designed by Israel, built in Dimona. So Israel waits for one of the many natural quakes in Japan to provide cover for a tsunami bomb that they already have at the bottom of the Japan Trench. VLF communications are established with the bomb to penetrate the water. Controllers in Dimona get seismic reading from Japan's quake, and boom, the tsunami comes in, swamps the Stuxnet-infected power plant, direct video feed from legitimate cameras verify this blast pattern. Dimona installs supposed security cameras that look very much like these nuclear devices, same exact dimensions. And the interesting thing about it is that this camera, when it was installed, weighed 3,000 pounds. Well, if you go to the website that makes these cameras, the camera actually weighs, there are three types. One is a binaural, that is a biocular. The other one is biocular with infrared. Both of those weigh less than 50 pounds. They can be set up by a single man in a tripod. The last one has a power supply and a recording device, and it probably weighs, it looks to be like a couple hundred pounds at the most. But these cameras that were installed at Fukushima weighed 3,000 pounds. 3,000 pounds, which is consistent with this weapon. So Jim goes quite a bit further than I'm willing to go tonight on this program, talking about what the motivations were, what was said, what the communications were. But the dots seem to line up here that Israel, in a stroke of self-defense, could not stop Iran by attacking Iran. So they protested as much as they could and then used their incredible high-tech abilities to stop Japan's supplier. The bottom line is this. Fukushima was impossible. It was impossible. The swamping of the external generators by the tsunami was irrelevant. Irrelevant. Even though some of the generators were underground in the basement and were flooded by the tsunami, the real emergency backup systems are not driven by electricity. They're driven by steam from the reactors themselves. That's why they're designed that way. No electricity is needed to operate three separate emergency systems at every reactor. Each of them will keep a reactor safe, even if only one works. Triple redundancy. It's interesting that all nine non-electrical backup systems across the three fueled reactors failed. This is technically impossible outside of willful intent and was likely the result of the Stuxnet virus. not allowing the valves to operate, not allowing the Siemens equipment to control the supervisory control and data acquisition system to make these pumps work. Stuxnet was designed specifically to target Siemens SCADA controllers and is most effective at tampering with fluid control systems. The centrifuges it attacked in Iran were ideal. So are the fluid-controlled systems at a nuclear facility. Oil refineries are equally at risk. Stuxnet is most dangerous when affecting a system which needs to control the flow of any liquid, be it hydraulic for cooling or valve operation. Stuxnet is documented to have been produced by the Israeli Defense Forces for the purpose of destroying any industrial system that can be destroyed by improper fluid flow. The code is quite simple. It is quite prolific, and it can be moved very, very easily from one system to another. It doesn't have to go over the net. Magna BSP is the camera manufacturer in Dimona. They have no history outside of the Israeli Defense Forces prior to the Fukushima contract. Magna BSP had a full-time internet link, two-way connection to the Fukushima reactor room all the way through the disaster. These are known facts, people. They told TEPCO about the communication on March 15th, which is 4 days after this occurred, after everything blew sky high, via an article printed in the Jerusalem Post. I have a copy of it. Why did Magna BSP wait until everything was blown sky high to tell TEPCO the data link existed and then did not tell them face to face? Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. Lots of questions, lots of proof, lots of evidence, and not much testimony. Let's see what the callers have to say about it. We got about 6 minutes left in this hour. Let's see if we can pull someone in. We have Cy from Canada on line two. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Pardon? Go ahead. I can hear you. You're a little scratchy, but go ahead.
Well, being in the middle of Canada, I'm just concerned about radiation readings because we don't get any. Our Canadian government is not giving us any readings at all, and I keep reading about the radiation readings in Oregon and Washington and in Europe. And I'm thinking, well, if they're there, they're probably here, but we're not getting any information.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. There are a couple of websites that actually post the pattern based on the jet stream and stratospheric temperatures of the drift of the radioactive cloud from the Fukushima reactor area. A couple of those sites were nuked. I mean, they were taken down. They were hacked and shut off. But there are people that got the data before the websites were taken down, copied the data, and relaunched it on other websites. So now it's gone viral, and you should be able to find the software online. There's probably 2,000 websites that have it posted now. They can't stop it. That information is getting out.
Thank you.
So you can find out where those clouds are going. Actually, Canada is quite a bit north. This seems to be going from like Washington State south all the way to Florida and then going across the globe. But it is going to expand. Now, normally, whenever we have a spill like this, Cy, we say dilution is the solution. But the source continues. Still dumping thousands of tons of radioactive material into the atmosphere and into the water. So the source is continuing. It's sort of like feeding it like a garden hose.
See, and that's my concern because the way the jet stream is this year, you see it looping way south and then it comes way up north. And so I figure the jet stream's picking it up because it's picking it up from the west coast and probably bringing it right over top of us.
Yep. I would say so. Now, the biggest culprit is rain. If it rains, it pulls the radioactive material out of the clouds, down into the ground. It gets into the ground, gets into the food you eat, and into the groundwater, and then you ingest it. And then some days or weeks or months later, that radioactivity begins to decay, and that's where the problem is. That's why you have to take iodine. And what the iodine does is it leaches the radioactive material out of your body, and you're able to flush it out of your body with water before it decays.
Okay.
That's
okay.
How the iodine works.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for calling. All right, so we have we've lit the fuse this first hour, and I don't mean to scare anybody. That's not the idea. The idea is to be empowered so that you know what's going on, so that you know when you look at the news what it is you're looking at, what the talking heads are saying and what they're not saying. And that is where things get pretty tricky. I'm going to try and pull this back together for you in the second hour and give you a little cause for hope. So don't go away. We'll play a little bit of Muse. This is appropriate now, so we'll just do this. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more X Squared Radio right after this.
Confined. I will love.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from southern Mississippi, just north of the Gulf Coast, if you want to be part of the program tonight. And we encourage you to do so. Please call in if you're off-planet, 530-413-4511. West of Earth, 530-413-4515. And east of Earth, 530-413-4520. We're knocking it wide open in this hour. Some people have asked questions, and that's good. We want you to ask questions. We want you to stay alert, stay bright, because what we're about to reveal is not only informative, it's empowering. And it's going to let you know what's really going on, so you know when the talking heads stand in front of the bully pulpit and tell you what's going on, you'll know what to believe and you'll know what not to believe. Stuxnet is a virus that is specifically written. The code is quite simple. It is actually usable for several different formats. Hackers have their hands on it now, as it has been for sale out there on the web, here and there. It has two modes of operation, random and administrative. It can be administered to optimize the damage. In other words, you select certain options in the virus to tell it how devastating you want it to be. And it can also transmit setup information and industrial system information to a remote computer. Once installed on the host system via a flash drive, that's the little thumb drive that you carry around, or an iPhone, it causes that system to violate its normal security protocols, and internet administration becomes possible if a connection exists. In other words, it facilitates hacking and remote control of the system from another location completely anonymously. Tampering is not visible on the control room readouts because Stuxnet learns what normal looks like and keeps the temperatures, pressure, and other readouts within normal limits so that the operators are oblivious to the destruction happening in secret. Stuxnet appeared in Japan in June of 2010, almost a year, not quite, 9 months before this event happened. It happened shortly after Magna BSP, that's the company that installed the security cameras from Dimona, Israel. 12 installers arrived and put high-tech cameras. When they were questioned about the manifest, why do these cameras weigh so much? Why do they weigh 3,000 pounds? The answer was, well, they're binocular. They take a stereoscopic picture so that you can tell distance. They're made by Magna BSP and highly lauded as state-of-the-art, as most everything made by Israeli companies is. It's able to identify a human shape in the dark, in the fog, in the smoke, in a sandstorm from as much as 1,500 meters away. Quite the camera system. If you go to their website, Magna BSP in Dimona, Israel, you can see the shape, the build of this camera. Large box at the bottom about the size of a cooler, a round tube that comes up out of the center of it like those cigarette extinguishing things you see in outdoor smoking areas, except it has places for two lenses that are very sensitive to infrared and visible radiation so they can give you a clear image. The cameras normally weigh enough where a couple of techs can set it up pretty easily. They have smaller models that you can backpack in and set up with a tripod. So these aren't terrifically heavy or bulky items. Some of them, as you can see on their website, are installed on the rooftop of buildings. These cameras were installed at the nuclear reactors in Japan by Magna BSP, by technicians that came from Dimona. These cameras didn't weigh a few hundred pounds. They weighed a few thousand pounds. It is suspected because when you look at the nuclear device that has been designed by Israel, they're identical in size, shape, and weight. I'm not doubting that they were also functioning as a camera, but they may have also been able to deliver the explosion that we saw on national television. If you look at the explosions that are well documented on the web of this weapon in test sequence, the shape of the cloud, the blast velocities, which are well above 5,500 meters per second. By the way, that's many, many, many times more powerful than a hydrogen explosion. A hydrogen explosion is just the recombination of hydrogen gas and oxygen to form water. This is really, although a loud explosion, not terrifically powerful. Many of you know by looking back in history at the Hindenburg. The Hindenburg was a blimp which was filled with hydrogen gas. Hydrogen gas is very lightweight, and so the Hindenburg was a lighter-than-air craft carrying a large gondola full of people. And as it was coming in, its arrival being announced on live radio, something happened. A static shock, some spark from the ground to the dirigible, it caught fire. The hydrogen in the bags inside this ship began exploding in giant flames. You could see, even though it was black and white photographs, it was still quite amazing to see. What most people don't know is almost everyone in the gondola survived, except those that jumped. They panicked. They jumped out the windows and, of course, didn't sprout wings. And when they hit the ground, it was a little bit too abrupt of a stop for the human system. However, those that rode it to the ground, when it finally settled to the ground, opened the doors and ran away virtually unharmed. How could that be? Because as I just told you, the hydrogen was recombining with oxygen, forming water. The people in the gondola were soaking wet from the water that was formed. It rained down on top of them, cooling the gondola and keeping it from any kind of damage from the flames. The flames went up. The gondola was on the bottom of the dirigible, and most of the people survived. So these hydrogen explosions are not that powerful, not enough to blow through 15 feet of reinforced concrete, not powerful enough to strip concrete off of rebar, which is how these modern reactors were constructed. Keep in mind that reactor number 4 had been defueled. There was no reaction going on inside of reactor number 4. The only thing that was in there was a waste pool, which could not have melted down. The blast that you saw on national television was not consistent with a hydrogen explosion. It was consistent with one of these packaged nukes. Jim goes on to say in his article, "I am a lifer in the types of control systems Fukushima and its clone, TVA-owned Brown's Ferry, have been upgraded to modern Siemens controllers running the Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition System, the SCADA. I, too, have been involved in these kinds of control systems my whole life. I didn't always use Siemens. We used Siemens in the last couple of plants I built, but I've used other Majorex systems and Bailey systems, and there are lots of systems out there. Siemens, only one of them. Stuxnet was designed to attack these systems. It was designed to live seamlessly and undetectably inside of Siemens equipment. Now, it gets very interesting here because I'm going to give you some facts that the news hasn't given you yet. I'll explain in detail why the problems before the explosion had to be sabotage. They had to be. There was no, they have multiple checks, both human checks and computer checks, every single day when these reactors are online. It is part of the human involvement in the maintenance and operation of a nuclear power plant. Even coal and gas-fired steam systems go through these checks. Every single hour, people walk around and check things, listen for things, read dials manually to make sure that these systems are in operation. The diesel generators were not out in the open as we were led to believe. They were, in fact, located in the basements of the turbine buildings. This is more an aesthetic decision than anything else. They were sealed off, and they were never significantly flooded. One of them stayed running the entire time. The diesel generator stayed running during the entire event, but the electrical switch gear attached to it disconnected for an unexplained reason, which made it useless. It was sitting there running, generating electricity, but the giant switch that carries the amperage, the kilowatts from the generator to the grid had been disconnected. That can only be done by tripping it or by manually lifting the switch. Each of the backup generators at Fukushima were capable of running 14,000 households each, which means they only had to be over 10 megawatts each. 10 megawatts is 10 million watts. There were several of them. Obviously, redundancy, redundancy, redundancy. It is obvious, then, that Fukushima was set up to survive on only one of 13 backup generators, and one kept running during the entire time. One would be many times larger than needed to run last-ditch backup systems at all reactors, but not keep business as usual. But that's not the real story, which is that even others, which were high and dry, they were on concrete stands above the ground, never got touched by the water. They stopped as well. So the interesting thing that that we notice is the one that kept running was never hooked up to the SCADA controller. It was a manual system. So why did the switchgear disconnect a working generator? That is the type of thing Stuxnet was designed to do. It was designed to find ways to keep the reactor from protecting itself. That's what it was crafted for. That's why it was designed. By the way, I want to correct myself. I said in the last hour by a misspoke that Israel, or that Japan was enriching uranium for Israel. That's not true. That never happened. Japan was enriching uranium for Iran. Iran, not Israel. Hey, let's go ahead and take a call. We got a couple lines here. Let's take Weehawken, New Jersey, line one. Welcome to the program. Weehawken, New Jersey, line one. Welcome to X Squared Radio. How are you, sir? I'm not hearing anything. We'll leave the line open in case he comes about, sails back into our calm pond of information.
This is Mick from Weehawken, New Jersey.
All right. Welcome to the program, Mick. How are you?
Oh, fine. Thank you, my friend. I listen as often as I possibly can. And although I don't listen every week, I do my best to listen to you as often as I possibly can. Tonight's show is particularly scary. I've been accused of being a conspiracy theorist myself on a number of occasions, and I do think that there's a connection between the United States, England, and Israel, and I always have felt that way for a long time. And I'm just, the first thing I want to ask you is, Israel is under a lot of pressure right now. There's a vote in the United Nations, coming up in September, and the failure of a flotilla to get away from Greece and to aid the Palestinians, obviously that pressure came from the United States and Israel. Greece is in a precarious economic situation right now, and that has something to do with it. That combined with the fact that what you're talking about tonight is really scary stuff, and sometimes in the back of one's mind, in the recesses, way back, sometimes one asks oneself, are there actually people in Israel who think that the survival of Israel is more important than the survival of planet Earth?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And survival, for this little state has always been in the form of self-defense. And some of that self-defense has been preemptive, going into other countries and taking decisive military action without permission, asking for forgiveness later. But, you know, flying into Iraq and blowing up a reactor is definitely an act of war. But they had to do it. Because had the material in that reactor proliferated, they would have lost communication, lost contact with it, and it eventually would have ended up right in their own neighborhoods. And the flotilla that you're talking about, you're absolutely right. It was just in the news this week that Israel refused to drop the blockade. A blockade is language that this country knows very well, as both Britain and the Union, our own Union, formed blockades to prevent ships from entering and leaving the United States to feed different colonies and factions that had seceded from the Union. Israel has had a blockade preventing aid to Palestine for quite a few years, and it's now falling on not so sympathetic ears. We just think internationally a little differently than Israel does. And I have friends that live on both sides of the fence over there, and I honestly don't understand the conflict. But I do understand that Iran may have nefarious plans with enriched uranium. And if you can't stop Iran, and it doesn't appear that even the UN nor the U.S. sanctions are able to do so, then you stop Iranian suppliers.
Well, all I know is that aside from a few notables like Alice Walker, a few, personalities. There were no American journalists taking part in that flotilla. There was representatives from every other country in the world almost, but not the United States.
Well,
and I think that to me is that says a great deal.
It does have a tendency to smack of endorsement, does it not?
It does, yeah. And I just want to say to you that I admire the work that you do, and I wish I listen to you as much as I can. I want to ask you a question, which is completely off the wall. But in one of your books, you had mentioned a comrade, a partner, a part of you, a queen that was an off-world relationship, and I was wondering if that was why you liked the Neil Young song so much after the Gold Rush. Am I right?
It may be. I like the Neil Young song after the Gold Rush.
Because I do. That's one of the songs I play. I really like it myself a lot.
Well, maybe you have a deep memory of someone, or the thing that amazes me about that song is. The idea of silver ships coming in and, rescuing.
I know the third verse is particularly interesting,
I was lying in a burned-out basement with a full moon in my eye, waiting for replacement. there's something to be said about that. And Neil Young, didn't pull any punches there. He definitely thought that
He's a straight-up guy. He's a straight-up guy,
I really like him, and he does great stuff for electric vehicles and all kinds of alternative fuels, and He's a great American. He's a great earthling. Let's put it that way.
Great show tonight, Brooks. I'll let others call in now.
I'll try not to make it so scary.
It's not scary. I mean, nothing surprises me anymore. But I know that we're coming up on 2012. There's a lot happening, and I've read a lot of esoteric literature pertaining to various, subjects, and I'm familiar with a lot of things, but Israel it's scary what Netanyahu and company are trying to do. It's so obvious,
He's elected, and then he takes his hard line, and then the people throw him out and elect somebody else. And then he sits on the sidelines and lets things kind of get a little bit out of control. And then
I don't always. Sorry to interrupt you, but I don't always believe that he was elected. I mean, I believe the gentleman who ran against Calderon in Mexico was elected, and he didn't get it because of CIA involvement in Mexico. We ourselves had Bush lost the election twice, and he was in the White House for 8 years. So. I know there's a large piece movement in Israel, a very large, a very significant peace movement in Israel that you never hear anything about in the mainstream media. And, you know, it's only through programs like this that you get a bit of the truth, and I just want to thank you for that.
So well, I really appreciate it, because that is really what we're about. When we talk about political science here, what we're trying to do is empower the people so that they realize how to keep themselves out of the way of the bulldozer blade, so to speak. You know, just stand on the sidelines and don't be provoked, and don't, you know, if they throw a war, just say, you know, we're not coming. And, you know, if they talk about building underground bases and going in them, just say, hey, you know what, we know about your underground bases. Just go ahead and get in them now and lock the door. We'll take it from here. You know,
I hope I can meet you at James's place up in Washington someday. And
that's one of my places,
you know. All the best, Brooks.
Maybe come down to Louisville in December. We'll meet.
If money is an issue, and I don't think that's going to happen, but someday. All the best, Brooks.
I appreciate it. Bye. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I don't want to make the truth so scary. Obviously, this news has already been broken. The idea has been much more provocatively put out there than I'm doing it tonight. I'm just trying to lay the facts out there for you so that you can see that if you do see a headline or two or a claim out there, even though it may be sensationalized, that there are some facts to back it up. That was no 8.6 earthquake. It was a 5.6 probably. I personally have been through a 6.0 quake. And I was thrown on the floor, and our living room chandelier swung back and forth and beat holes in the ceiling until insulation fell down on our carpet. It broke glass. It threw telephone lines down. It ruptured streets and gas mains and water mains. And things were shut down for 3 or 4 days. No, there wasn't a tsunami, but there was a giant opening, shall we say, off the coast, and large gas bubbles were coming up out of the ground, and people were pretty skittish for a couple of weeks. That was a 6.0, which is about consistent with a 5.6. It's unnerving. You can't jump up in the air and stay there. That's not going to happen. But you can, you know, get yourself in a doorway or get out from underneath something that might fall on you and ride it out, which is exactly what these people did in the video. And when you look at the photographs of the neighborhoods in the area, it's consistent with a 5.6 or a 6.0. The wooden buildings are still standing. All the cars are parked in nice, neat rows right up against the beach behind the seawall. Even aluminum awnings, which are just sitting there in parking lots over cars to protect them from too much sunshine or hail from some of the northern storms that they get on that end of Japan. Even the statues that were standing up in the parks, still standing there. That would not happen. If that was an 8.6, it would have looked like the quake in Kobe, Japan. You would have seen streets broken up. You would have seen wooden houses broken apart like Tinker Toys. You would have seen concrete buildings up on stilts leaning over. You would have seen cars thrown about like toys long before the tsunami ever came over the wall. But as the tsunami was breaking over the wall and getting ready to flood that area, nothing. No damage whatsoever. Nobody in the streets. Nobody panicking. It was a little trembler. Nothing very heavy. Epicenter was between 50 and 140 miles off the coast. If that quake had been that strong, they would have felt it all the way in Tokyo. They didn't. So, the facts are what they are. And a fact is a direct observation. A fact is a photograph. A fact is a hard recording of something like a seismogram that should have shown an 8.6. It did not. It showed a 5.6. And the video that ran showed office workers laughing and kind of holding on to desks and letting everything hit the floor, kind of like they do. And every time there's a medium-sized earthquake in Japan, you get used to it. But when you start seeing complex supervisory control and data acquisition systems failing in a catastrophic way, generators sitting there running, cranking out megawatts of electricity, none of it going anywhere because mysteriously the switchgear has been opened. When you have steam-powered pumps that are supposed to run in the case of an emergency, that's what they're designed to do, and they check them, and they recheck them, and they test them, and they dry test them. One had to work. 13 didn't work. And you have reports nearly a year, 9 months before this event, that the Stuxnet virus was alive and well in the nuclear power plants operating with Siemens equipment. And by the way, Siemens was purchased about a year before this event by, you got it, Israeli companies. Israeli investors control the Siemens division. There were also battery backups. They're called USPs or UPSs, uninterruptible power supplies. Batteries held, leaving only a one-hour gap in time where there was no power present to run things before adequate off-site power drove into the facility on the road, all nice and ready to hook up, but was denied to by switchgear, which was reportedly swamped. It could have been replaced even before the batteries died. The fact that off-site generators were able to be driven into the facility also proves, by the way, the earthquake could not have been an 8.6. Because if that quake had been an 8.6, you would not have been able to drive those generators in there. The roads would have had 12-inch cracks in them where these trucks could not gain access. Now, reactor number 3, we talked about reactor number 4 exploding, and you saw the blast on national television. You also know the facts now that reactor number 4 was offline. There was no fuel in it. The fuel had been removed. It was having the stainless steel liner replaced. Reactor number 3 also exploded entirely. Yet this reactor had the most functional backup systems. It clearly means that some software, some design was behind this breakdown. It could not have occurred the way it occurred. Each reactor, and these are modern reactors, not like U.S. reactors built in the late 60s and early 70s. We haven't had a new nuclear power plant built in the United States in over 25 years because permitting has become impossible. We've had upgrades, lots of upgrades to the existing facilities, but events like Three Mile Island make people pretty nervous about having a nuclear power plant in their own backyard. The one in Nebraska is offline right now because, and secured because of the flooding, but no danger there. Each reactor has 8 separate emergency backup systems because these were designed by GE and Toshiba. They're the most modern reactors in the world. Each of these systems is capable of saving the reactor on its own. 3 are designed to function perfectly if all power is lost and even the generators fail. Fukushima didn't even need electrical systems operating at all to keep itself from blowing up. When power is lost, steam from the reactors is automatically diverted to the generator turbines, to totally separate steam turbines connected to totally separate water pumps, needing only reactor steam to power them. I've used steam-powered compressors in an automotive manufacturing plant, and we tested them from time to time just to make sure that critical systems inside the manufacturing facility could have a minimum amount of compressed air to function. It was a steam-powered air compressor, just like these are steam-powered water pumps. They don't even need electricity. They just need valves to open when they're supposed to. But these valves were controlled by the Siemens software, which had been compromised by the Stuxnet virus. And the Stuxnet virus was written and installed by companies that came from Israel. Okay, we got a couple more lines filled up. Let's see here. Antonin, line two, welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. Antonin Fiore. How are you, my friend?
I am so good. Thank you for joining us tonight.
You bet. Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the show and the research and the information that you've presented. As usual, it's outstanding and very informative. And I wanted to call in because I've been working recently on some content for my program, The Crimson Pill, and a presentation that I'm putting together that, at least for the moment, my working title is The Curious Case of Smedley Butler. Are you familiar, Dr. Agnew, with Smedley Butler and his story?
I am not. I'm not. I'm so excited. With a name like that, I'm hanging on the edge of my seat. Tell me about it.
Well, really, this is in regard to the notion that, you know, you had said you're going to try not to scare the listeners quite so much. And so I felt it incumbent upon me to call in and take over that role for you. So I'd like to spend just a couple minutes talking about Smedley Butler in hopes that it will scare people at least into doing some research of their own, if not, in fact, maybe becoming a little bit more active about this news. Smedley Butler was a major general in the United States Marine Corps. At the time of his death, he was the most decorated Marine in U.S. history. It was a 34-year career that he had in the Marines. During that time, his lifespan, by the way, was from, he was born in 1881. He passed away in 1940. He participated in military actions in the Philippines, in China, in Central America, and the Caribbean during the Banana Wars, and then also in France during World War I. Just to paint a little more context of his career and the value of his service and his sacrifices to our nation, by the end of his career, he had received 16 medals, five of which were for heroism. He's one of only 19 people to twice receive the Medal of Honor, one of three to be awarded both the Marine Corps Brevet Medal as well as the Medal of Honor, and the only person to be awarded both the Brevet Medal as well as two Medals of Honor, all for separate actions. So he was a very committed and dedicated and valuable, obviously, member of our military.
And he was slightly indestructible, it appears.
It sure seems that way, doesn't it? Yes, exactly. And what's most interesting about what I call the curious case of Smedley Butler came at the end of his career, when he began to become very outspoken about what he had experienced and how he saw, looking back at the end of his career on the work that he did, where he went, and what he was asked to do, he put it into some very chilling context. And I'd like to read for you a quote from an article that was written about him. He says in this quote, "I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period I spent most of my time as a high-class thug for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers from 1902 to 1912. I brought light, I think that's significant, to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies in 1903. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents." These are Smedley Butler's own words in reflection upon his career And even at just this, I find that a bit chilling. How about you, Dr.
Well,
Agnew?
You know, no disrespect to Smedley, but it's no global secret that America practices a kind of imperial expansion through the use of violence. Now we have, you know, always called this kind of the Monroe Doctrine. We feed money to our friends, especially if they are enemies of our enemies, and we make things very hard for our enemies. And I think most of the major countries, China, Russia, others, have kind of copied that style. Now, Monroe certainly did not want us to take over the world. That wasn't the idea of it at all. What Monroe, by setting up his doctrine, and by the way, this was done, you know, shortly after the Louisiana Purchase, it was to kind of help along American interests around the world so that we could survive as a nation. We were rather young, impetuous. We didn't have a real united leadership. We had a lot of problems keeping our states in line. You remember, we were the United States of America, which is plural. And after the Civil War, we became the United States of America, singular. So we had our problems. The Monroe Doctrine was designed to spread American interests worldwide. And unfortunately, and as is evident by Smedley's words here, we have often done that through violence. And we have even done it through fabricated wars. You remember a great journalist, I was going to say, I use the word journalist, that's not exactly what I meant. A great newspaper magnate. He was, for all intents and purposes, a billionaire, and his daughter even helped. I think it was the Lebanese Liberation Army or Palestinian Liberation Army. I can't remember. Anyway, he practiced what is called yellow journalism. He stated one time that he needed a war in order to sell papers, and he even made this statement: "You bring me a photograph, and I will make you a war." And so there was an American vessel that happened to be in Spanish waters that had a boiler accident and exploded. Somebody got a photograph of it. Well, this newspaper magnate, I'm trying not to use his name because that's not what the program is about. But the newspaper magnate used the photo and the headline that the Spanish had attacked an American vessel, many lives were lost. And the next thing you know, we had the Spanish-American War. Now, it was short. We went over and sunk their fleet in a harbor somewhere, and it was over. But he sold a lot of papers. We have tendency as a planet, and my very, very close friend and teacher and I were discussing this all day today. How this planet has been kept at war with itself while these industrialists, bankers, global corporations feed weapons and supplies to both sides.
Quite right. Quite right. And in fact, Dr. Agnew, the element or the part of Smedley Butler's story that I find most germane to the topic that you have is kind of the featured subject tonight, which is, you know, what really happened at Fukushima, in essence. It comes at the end of his life in what is called, and for those that might be taking notes or researching, you know, in the listening audience, do a search for and research what's called the business plot. In November of 1934, Smedley Butler alleged the existence of a political conspiracy driven chiefly by Wall Street interests to overthrow President Roosevelt. And again, these allegations, and also the House of Representatives committee that was appointed and investigated, it was quite a large affair. There's a lot of documentation about this. Again, it's kind of referred to generically as the business plot. A special committee of the House of Representatives, headed by John W. McCormick of Massachusetts, Samuel Dickstein of New York. I'm going to kind of skip through here a little bit to fast forward to the conclusion that this House committee report issued. And this is a quote. It's taken directly from the final report or the findings. The committee, quote, purported to report that a two-month investigation had convinced it, the committee, that General Butler's story of a fascist march on Washington was alarmingly true, and, once again quoting, also alleged that definite proof had been found that the much-publicized fascist march on Washington, this was going to be the coup, the overthrow. And the reason that Butler is so intimately aware of these facts is because he was recruited by these banking interests to head the effort. They had already secured the services of what's believed to be more than 500,000 soldiers, if you will, former military personnel, intelligence community, etc., that they were to be his army. And Butler was recruited to lead this effort. So now I'm going to continue to quote the final sentence. Also alleged that definite proof had been found that the much-publicized fascist march on Washington, which was to have been led by Smedley Butler, was actually contemplated. And then the final quote here, and this is really the key, I believe. In the last few weeks of the committee's official life, it received evidence showing that certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient. And now if I can make an analogy here, if you're being held at gunpoint by someone, you know, threatened, your life is threatened if you don't hand over your wallet, then if we jump to the end and kind of make this like an algebra equation, if at the end we realize that you did not get shot, then we must make the assumption that you complied with their wishes, that you handed over the money.
There you go. Yeah, you didn't get hurt, so therefore they weren't aiming at you. I got it.
Or that you complied with what they asked. And right. As the committee report says, might have been placed, there's no question that the attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient. So apparently they did not deem it expedient. And I'd like to offer the punchline as to why they did not deem it expedient.
Okay, go ahead.
It's called the Emergency Banking Act of March 9, 1933. Franklin Roosevelt did comply. He did hand over the wallet.
What did this
We know quite a lot, actually, about the ramifications of the Emergency Banking Act.
What
Federal
did it put-
Reserve Bank...
What did the Emergency Banking Act put in place?
Oh, quite a lot. The act allows only Federal Reserve approved banks to operate in the United States, first and foremost.
There you go. So the Federal Reserve was actually put in place with this Bankers Act and given primary fund control over all American banks.
Well, actually, technically, the Federal Reserve had been created and put into place years earlier, but it was as a result of this act that the Federal Reserve was empowered to the extent that they remain today.
That's right. American banks were lending their own money. They were flush, and they were buying money from one another. What happened with this act is that the Federal Reserve became the sole source for primary money.
Precisely. Along with several of the elements of this act that are chilling and also provide context as to how things are happening behind the scenes the way they are today. For example, Title I, Section 2, to give the president the ability to declare a national emergency and have absolute control over the national finances and foreign exchange of the United States in the event of such an emergency. And it continues, you know, the text, the sections, the titles of the act. You really realize that these were the final nails in the coffin. This act is actually what many people generically refer to as the bankruptcy of the United States, which is in fact the case. The United States government went bankrupt in 1933. What's called the Secretary of the Treasury is actually the trustee of the bankruptcy. And this explains, kind of flowing backward once again, exactly how and why the robbery, the great robbery, took place.
Well, you know, of the presidential candidates that are running right now, there may be more along coming soon, the only one that's been willing in the debates to actually mention the term Federal Reserve has been Ron Paul.
Quite right, yes. Yes.
So, I guess it's interesting to watch the candidates.
I guess just to close the circle, Brooks, of the reason I called and wanted to mention this curious case of Smedley Butler and the business plot and the Emergency Banking Act of 1933 is because it, in relation to the subject matter, what happened at Fukushima, what happened with Japan, there's also some news that was released prior to those events that Japan was looking at divesting of much of their holdings in United States treasuries and debt instruments. And that speculation reminds me quite a lot of the allegations here in the business plot, that if you don't comply, we are ready, willing, and able to make you regret not complying with what we are telling you to do.
Well, that being said, you know, I was flying recently, and there was a woman in front of me who was about to go through the typical pat down, and she held up her hands and said, "Wait a minute! Whoa! Wait!" She said, and everyone could hear her. I mean, everybody looked up because this woman was pretty. She was pretty, and she was loud, and she said, "Look, Osama bin Laden is dead. I thought you guys would have gone home by now." And he said, No. There are many more threats out there." And this woman said, "I want my country back." Oh, my gosh. There were like 400 people in this security line. And it was like 1 second, 2 seconds, and then everybody put their head down and continued to take their shoes off and their belt off. Nobody said a word. And all of a sudden in my mind, Antonin, you're going to freak out when I tell you this. In my mind, the whole picture went black and white. And I went all the way back to 1941, and I saw a whole bunch of Holocaust Jews taking their clothes off and putting it in bins.
Oh, my.
That's what I saw.
Dr. Agnew, you are an intuitive, and so when I hear you describe an experience like that, to me, that means it's clearly, you know, far more than just allegorical. With your spiritual centeredness and your intuition, that is chilling to me. You're right. I did just freak out, but I appreciate you sharing that nonetheless.
Well, Antonin, stay tuned for the third hour, because we are going to reveal some movement that's been taking place in the United States that's going to blow your mind. We don't normally do conspiracy theories, but I can't leave this alone. It's just amazing. I got 10 minutes left in this hour to wrap this up. I appreciate the call, Antonin. Please don't be a stranger. By the way, Antonin has his own program on BBS Radio called The Crimson Pill. Been on it. Love it. Keep listening.
Thank you so much, friend. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. All right, listen, 40 seconds. I got to catch my breath. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness.
We don't have much time in this hour. I'm going to return to the subject matter at hand to give you an idea how big the reactors of Fukushima are. You really can't tell by looking down at them from space. I'm going to give you an idea. These are top-of-the-line reactors at Fukushima, both of them. And they're nearly identical to the American twin, Tennessee Valley Authority owned Brown's Ferry. There is a yellow dome that sits over this, on top of it, and it's even bigger. Keep in mind that this yellow containment dome was removed from Fukushima number 4 as that reactor was in service. It had been defueled. There is over 150 feet of reactor that sits below that yellow cap. Hydrogen will not vaporize this dome, which was in place for reactor number 3, by the way, which was operational. Only the high velocities consistent with a nuclear weapon would strip 4,000-pound concrete from steel reinforcement rods cast into that concrete. And by the way, this has to be fully cured and X-rayed concrete. There were no flaws in any of this. The reactors are about 14 digits beyond incapable of going supercritical, even with a complete core meltdown. There is a polished steel tube underneath the reactor, which is inclined toward the sea. If that core melts down, it drops through the floor, hits that 1-foot-thick steel tube, and really drains right into the ocean. It can't go supercritical. There's nothing to build up pressures capable of blowing that dome off. The explosions we saw in Japan were impossible unless something else was in place. Magna BSP had access to the reactors at this facility. They were based in Dimona, Israel, which is a military base that manufactures nuclear weapons. They have their own high-security reactor right there. Reporters can't get within 1,000 yards of this place with cameras. Stuxnet was made in their yard. They are stated to be a military company. Go to their website and check it out. There is extremely strong evidence that Dimona-based Magna BSP placed nuclear weapons at the exploded or vanished reactors at Fukushima, possibly hidden inside one of their unbelievably giant stereoscopic cameras. And by the way, these cameras, unlike the ones they sell on their website, weighed several thousand pounds. These cameras were installed inside the reactor containment of Fukushima. These are capable of picking up a human form at 1,500 meters. Why they were inside the reactor when a simple closed-circuit TV would have done just fine is beyond me. It was placed inside the containment of Fukushima Reactor Number 3 under the cover of a security contract less than a year prior to the disaster. These cameras are identical in size, appearance, and weight to a gun-type nuclear weapon. Since previous hydrogen explosions at boiling water reactors have never, not at Three Mile Island, not at any nuclear facility, caused any sort of damage to equipment or buildings, even during complete meltdowns, it begs the question how on earth one at Reactor 3 produced a mushroom cloud. Three Mile Island sits in the evidence pool against what we have been told by the press about Fukushima. History does matter. There's a lot more proof. I wish I could have got into it in this hour. We're going to tie it all together in the third hour. Don't fret one bit, because there's more to come. I'm telling you, I'm not trying to scare you. I'm just trying to tell you there are forces out there working very diligently, very high, in a high-tech manner, very organized, under extreme security, to put together a plan to take apart a reactor which very clearly, very publicly, would have made enriched uranium for one, Iran, which is an enemy, an outspoken, an unabashed, proud, leadership, wealthy, well-engineered, well-educated enemy of Israel. And that's just the way it's coming together. I wish things were otherwise, but maybe they will be now that you're empowered with this new information. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio right after this.
Saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio, coming to you from southern Mississippi. Our AccuWindow forecast, rain right now. It has rained just about every day. Yesterday was amazing. I was down at the Shed, which is a place where they make pulled pork barbecue, and it was pretty amazing. Some pretty good eating, pretty amazing people, great motorcycles, great rat rods. Those of you that don't know what a rat rod is, it's just an old trashed out, pieced together Frankenstein of a vehicle that you can put together using 1920s, 40s, 50s, 70s. You get it, the idea. And it's got to be ratty. It's got to be put together with some pretty ratty stuff. But it doesn't just chug down the street. Oh, no, 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 no. Some of these have 700 horsepower, full-blown engines. Very nice. Very nice stuff. Very impressed by it. Couple of quick items. Next week, the 15th and 16th, we will be in Phoenix at the MUFON. If you're in the area, please join us. We're going to give the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition presentation. And coming up December 21st in Louisville with a new reduced price, by the way, $399, and there are other discounts available. You can go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the Pythagoras Conference banner. 20 world-class speakers in the Midwest. Go figure. Yeah, that's right. Thanks to Sandra Sabatini and her great work, taking a great risk to bring the very best from our genre to you in the Midwest within driving distance. So no airplane ticket, and believe me, this is first class all the way. The Galt House. Yeah, the Galt House on the river in Louisville, December 21st. Check it out, xsquaredradio.com. Click on the Pythagoras Conference banner. And join us. Governor Jerry Brown has signed into law California's tax on the internet sales through affiliate advertising, which will immediately cut small business website revenue 20 to 30%, experts say. Oh, it's much worse than that. The nefarious tricksters of the California legislature were counting their chickens before they hatch. Oh, they must have been sitting around the table going, we have finally crafted Bill AB28X, and it's going to take place immediately, and we're going to collect millions in new revenue, because look at all the internet business that goes on in the state of California. The State Board of Equalization says the tax will raise $200 million a year, but critics claim it will raise nothing, because online retailers will end their affiliate programs rather than collect the tax for California. Guess what? They were right. Oh, this is a headline. Amazon, one of the largest online retailers of all time, has already emailed its termination, you're fired of its affiliate advertising programs like X Squared Radio and others with 25,000 website small businesses. The bill specifically imposes the collection of taxes from consumers on sales by online retailers, including but not limited to those referred by California-based marketing affiliates like me and you, even if those retailers have no physical presence in the state. Did I mention I was in southern Mississippi? Yes, in fact, I am. Well, Amazon says we oppose this bill because it is unconstitutional and counterproductive. It is supported by big box realtors, or I'm sorry, retailers. They might be realtors too, but they're retailers. I think you know who they are, Sears, most of which are based already outside California, that seek to harm the affiliate advertising programs of their competitors, like X Squared Radio. Similar legislation in other states has led to job and income losses and little, if any, new tax revenue. Amazon deeply regrets that they must take this action. How about that? One more nail in the coffin of American small business driven by government. How about that? 25,000 small businesses put out of business overnight with the stroke of a pen. Unbelievable. Unbelievable short-sighted greed. They should all be fired. Hey, we can do that in this country, you know. All we have to do is march down to our local polling office and pull another handle. It can be done. We could fire them all in one election. Now, tell me that wouldn't make some history. I think it would be pretty cool myself. So let's get down to the facts here. There are some things lining up that are really amazing here. We've talked about the ultimate defense maneuver. We've proven it. We've documented it. We've given you the names. We've given you the websites. We've given you the dates. We pull no punches. There's no conspiracy theory here. There is enough evidence here to go to court. There's enough evidence here to claim that it was done. And guess what? Iran has already said that it occurred. But then again, who's listening to Iran? Seems like we have another military move going on over in Libya, and we've been listening to the press on that one. Maybe we should take a look at those facts again. Nah, that's not what we do here at X Squared Radio. We're looking at a scientific disaster. Every single safety system designed by some of the world's best engineers, safety engineers, engineers to watch the safety engineers, experts and statistical experts to watch the engineers that are watching the safety engineers, backup after backup. What if this happens? What if that happens? What if it's hit by an asteroid? What if there's an earthquake? What if there's a tsunami? I mean, it's not like they came up with the name or anything. Oh, yeah, okay, they did come up with the name. Tsunami is Japanese. But you realize that this could have all been avoided years ago if Carter had not stopped the solution? Jimmy, that Carter, you remember the one. One-term Jimmy, giveaway Panama Canal Jimmy, you know who I'm talking about now? Okay, you got it. There was closed-loop technology that was available way back then that would have prevented outside access. It was vetoed. And so these SCADA controls, these external supervisory control and data acquisition systems, are all externally accessible from outside, as they were by Dimona. Interesting how all this comes together. how it all could have been avoided. It's almost as though things were planned and laid out well in advance. Certainly not. Oh, they can't think that far ahead. Come on. All right, if you're gonna text me, you're gonna write me messages and stuff, make them short, okay? Don't send me paragraphs because I can't read them. If I read them, it's kind of like I stop in the middle of a sentence and listeners are going, what's he doing over there? Is he surfing the web? No, I'm not surfing the web. People are texting me, but they're texting me whole paragraphs. I can't read them, folks. Make them short. One or two sentences, 25 words or less. Come on, help me out a little bit here. We're in the final hour of X Squared Radio. I can't read your text and talk at the same time. Okay, I can, but I don't want to, okay, because it's the final hour and I'm into it now. I want to get this done. So I want you to ponder the things that we talked about, and then I want you to consider this. Over the last few months, train loads of military equipment have been moving around the country. These are not your ordinary convoys, all right? And every once in a while, you ride along the freeway, you see a few Hummers, a few troop carriers that are moving some barrels or stuff around. Not like that. We're talking about helicopters, armored personnel carriers, eight-wheel drives, and even UN-colored vehicles. That's UN like United Nations, okay? Not UN. United Nations vehicles on flatbeds all over the Northwest. Nebraska, North Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, what's going on? This is not a small amount of equipment moving. This isn't a country that's on the verge of bankruptcy. Billions of dollars worth of equipment and troops are being moved around, and not all in plain sight. Many reports of plain white vans holding 12 troops, fully outfitted, I might add, everything, helmet, sunglasses, everything, dozens of them. And guess where they are? They're at Walmart. No, they're not there at Walmart. They're shopping at Walmart. That's right. Bottled water, food, supplies. They're filling up rental trucks full of supplies, and they're on the move. It has been happening. It's happening where you are. I want you to do this. Somebody sent me this note today. I want you to follow up on it. Don't go anywhere without a camera. If you're out driving the freeways, if you're driving the back roads, if you have a railroad that goes by your house, keep a camera with you. You start realizing that assets are moving around this country, we'd like to know about it. We need to know what kind of military activities are going on in our own country. I'm not talking National Guard. I'm not talking about relief efforts for the floods along the Mississippi River. I'm talking about regular army. I'm talking about United Nations troops and materials moving around our country. And this is recent. Last month, the month before, going all the way back as far as October. And then this. This just came out June 9th. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and the Federal Communications Commission, that's the FCC, those are the ones that monitor all airwaves, all cable, all radio, all television. They will conduct the first nationwide test of the Emergency Alert System, the EAS. You remember those, right? Used to be called, this is a test of the emergency broadcast system. The following, if this were a real emergency, blah, 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 blah. You know those, like get back to the song. Anyway, the nationwide test will occur on Wednesday, November 9th of this year at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and may last up to 3.5 minutes. I want you to write that date down. November 9th, 2 p.m. You don't have to put it on your fridge. This is just to enhance your short-term memory because I'm going to tie that date with the exact date for another item in just a moment. The Emergency Alert System is a national alert and warning system established to enable the President of the United States to address the American public during emergencies. NOAA's National Weather Service, governors, and state and local emergency authorities who also use parts of the system to issue more localized emergency alerts. Similar to local EAS tests, like the one I just mimicked for you that you've often heard on the radio or on television, that are already conducted frequently, the nationwide test will involve broadcast radio and television stations, cable television, satellite radio and television services, and wireline video service providers across all states and the territories of Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and American Samoa. On November 9th, the public will hear a message indicating that this is a test, .. The audio message will be the same for both radio and television. Under the FCC's rules, regulations, laws, statutes, radio and television broadcasters, cable operators, satellite digital audio radio service providers, direct broadcast satellite service providers, and wireline video service providers are required to receive and transmit presidential EAS messages to the public. A national test will help the federal partners and EAS participants to determine the reliability of the system and its effectiveness in notifying the public of emergencies and potential dangers nationally and regionally. Here's a quote. A national test of our emergency alert system with the vital communication support and involvement of participants is a step toward ensuring that the alert and warning community is prepared to deliver critical information that can help save lives and protect property, close quote. This was said by Damon Penn, FEMA's Assistant Administrator of National Continuity Programs. He goes on, because there has never, let me repeat that, because there has never been an activation of the emergency alert system on a national level, FEMA views this test as an excellent opportunity to assess the readiness and effectiveness of the current system. It is important to remember that this is not a pass or fail test, but a chance to establish a baseline for making incremental improvements to the emergency alert system with ongoing and future testing. I don't want to read the rest of the article because it's just filler. Here is the important reason that November 9th, 2011 is so important. It just so happens on that date, that we have a visitor coming to visit us. Hang on, I'm writing back a texter. The visitor isn't from our neighborhood. It's an asteroid. JPL has been tracking it. YU-56. 2005 YU-56. It's an asteroid. As you know, September of this year, we have the very mysterious comet Elenin heading our way. Now, I don't really know a lot about Elenin, and neither does anybody. We can't even find the guy Elenin. We can't find anything on the guy Elenin. We can't find any new photos of Elenin. We can't get an updated trajectory of Elenin. When you put in the coordinates where Elenin is supposed to be into Google Sky and you zoom into its maximum resolution, there's no Elenin. Nothing but stars and galaxy and blackness of space. But there's no Elenin. Elenin is supposed to arrive a mere 23 million miles from Earth, half the distance between Earth and Mars. Should be very visible about now, but nobody, of course, can actually see it. And a few weeks after that, this asteroid is supposed to come through within one lunar distance of Earth. That would be 275,000 miles or closer, by the way. We're not really sure how big the asteroid is. There are some estimates, but we don't know how dense it is. And it could be very dense. It could be 14 grams per cubic centimeter. It could be very fluffy like green cheese. We just don't know. But if it's heavy and it passes within one lunar distance of Earth, it's going to tug on Earth. It's definitely going to tug on the moon. According to JPL's online visualization, their animation of this close pass by this asteroid, the moon will not be on the opposite side of the Earth from this asteroid. Rather, it will be almost parallel. That is to say, when the asteroid passes, the Earth and the moon will be on a parallel course with this asteroid. That means that the moon, which is facing the Earth because it's in this geosynchronous orbit, that is to say, it revolves on its axis at the same rate at which it orbits the Earth. That way we see the same side of the moon all the time. There is no real dark side of the moon. I forgot to tell you that. The sun goes around, we go around the sun together as a pair, the Earth and the moon. And so the other side of the moon gets just as much sunlight as the side that faces us. So it's not dark, it's just not seen. It has a lot more craters on it, and it's estimated that the crust on that side of the moon is much thicker, more heavy, than the side that faces the Earth. And that's why the moon has the orbit that it has. It wobbles a little bit back and forth, about 1 degree, and maybe when it's dark, that is to say a new moon, it wobbles about 1 degree, and we can see a little bit more of the moon than when it's light. That's not really amazing to us. We'd like to see the moon revolving so that we can see all sides. Not really. Don't start the moon revolving. That could cause effects that we're not ready for. However, if this asteroid goes by and it tugs on the moon, it could wobble that moon. And that could be very devastating to the Earth. You know, the moon is responsible, and very romantically so, in the tides of our ocean. So if the moon wobbles a little bit, it could have an effect on our tides, which could have an effect on the way water moves in our currents. Because, you know, as the tides are affected by the tidal gravity of the moon, and that's T-I-D-A-L, tidal gravity, which is kind of a stretching, squeezing effect even a gravitational body as small as the moon has on the Earth. And because the oceans are liquid, they respond to it the best. We get used to it. In the north, the tides can be as high as 30 feet, and in the south, you know, barely a few feet. Down here on the Gulf of Mexico, it's only a few feet. Up in Boston, it's quite the tide. In Alaska, it can be really a high tide and low tide. So we have this extraterrestrial visitor coming through, getting ready to wreak gravitational effects on our immediate zone of the solar system, and it happens to be arriving on November 9th. Yeah, it happens to be arriving on the same day that they're going to test the EAS nationally. They're going to, for 3 minutes, seize control of all communications in the country. The only way that you'll be able to communicate outside of this system during these few minutes that the EAS has control, because they have set up the rules, laws, and statutes that make it impossible for licensed airwave holders or access providers or access ease to any of the cable or hardline systems to deny access to the EAS or refuse to broadcast the EAS. The only way to have communication during this period is with ham radio or CB radio. So if you want to gear yourself up, I suggest you get down to your used radio shop, pick up a Yaesu or a Kenwood or a Panasonic. Get your hands on a radio, because if they can seize control of the communication system once, they can do it any time they want. Now, I am told by one of my most loyal texters that currently the call-in number for X Squared Radio for this hour has been playing music. It could be that our content tonight is so controversial that someone has hacked into the phone lines and stopped the program from going out by telephone. So if you're in the studio, see if you can reboot that system and bring our phone listeners back online. I would, and they would most appreciate it. Some people don't have a computer to listen. They call in using their cell phones. And by the way, you can put this on your speed dial because this is going to be the number for a while. If you want to listen to the program with your cell phone, you can do so. We have like a giant conference line. You can just call 760-569-7676 and then put in the access code 630-931-pound, 630-931-pound. We also have a toll-free number. We have about 20 minutes left in the program if you want to call in and make a comment. If you have seen large amounts of troops or equipment or trains or helicopters or black things floating about, you can give us a call and let us know. It's 888-260-3070. If you want to call in on one of the regular lines, you have unlimited minutes on your cell phone, free nights and weekends, which we're on the weekend, folks. You can call, if you're off planet, 530-413-4511. I shudder to think what the long-distance charges are from there, but not my problem. If you're west of Earth, it's 530-413-4515. And if you're east of Earth, it's 530-413-4520. Does a nation have a right to defend itself? Yes, it does. And by what means? Well, non-lethal means, hopefully. And so I would think that even if Israel was responsible for placing the Stuxnet virus, and even if the Dimona company did place nuclear weapons next to the reactors, and even if those weapons were detonated, creating the explosion which took these reactors out, it could be seen as an act of self-defense. Because not long ago, Japan announced that it would be enriching uranium and selling this enriched uranium to Iran, which is an outspoken, makes no bones about it, enemy of Israel. I should be more clear with that. They're not an enemy of Israel. They're an enemy of the occupants of Israel. You know, they have a different geography, different geographical maps than we have. So I think maybe they have the right to defend themselves. And I think that they're not making any apologies about it. What I do want to make sure of is that you, the listener, you, the Earth Explorer, are completely empowered to make your own decisions based on facts, not based on propaganda, not based on false reporting. Okay, let me just come out and say it. Not based upon lies. Here at X Squared Radio, we realize anything put into the formula of X squared is going to come out positive. That's why we made the station the way it is. That's why this program is what it is. I make an effort to bring you only factual information. Yes, I put my personal opinion in from time to time, but I'll tell you it's my opinion. Tonight, I have given you facts. Tonight, I have given you what you have not heard in the press, unless you happen to be out there listening to the wonderful work done by Jim Stone at Jim Stone Freelance, like freelance writer.com. I highly suggest that you access the link that was sent to you in your newsletter, access the link that was sent out in the alert by BBS Radio, or go back and play this audio over again and write that link down, jimstonefreelance.com. Visit his website, and if you email him, be sure to tell him that you heard about his information here on X Squared Radio, and I did my best to do it justice. He has done the investigative report that split this wide open, broke it on Feet to Fire on Janik's program, and really made a global presence. Because if you do any kind of Google search for Fukushima and Iran, this is what you're going to come up with. You do any kind of Google search on the words Israel and Fukushima, you'll see this article. You'll see the comments on the comments. You'll see all the facts for yourself. I wanted to cover it from a primarily more scientific point of view here so that you could fill in the technical gaps between what was actually done, what you actually saw, and what was being reported. That's we have Mick back. I just want to say you might have missed a few things. We're getting close to the end of the program. Let's go ahead and bring him back on. Mick, welcome back to the program. Anytime.
Thank you, Brooks. I when you said that there was possibly some interference with the phone lines because of the nature of the program and the commentary, I immediately called back to see if I could get through, just to check, you know, because obviously we're dealing with fascism here.
Well, it wasn't the call.
You were beginning to talk about
it was the conference
asking call. People to watch out for people in the military and civilian areas. They may or may not be aware of the term posse comitatus, which is a law that says that military people are not supposed to be doing civilian police jobs in the contiguous 48 states of the United States.
That's correct.
50 states, for that matter. And when I live in New Jersey, when I go to Port Authority in New York City, and there's people in olive drab uniforms with, you know, heavily armed people in the bus stop, you know, I want to walk up to them and say to them, are you aware of the fact that there's a law that says you're not supposed to be here? But I don't do it because I know I'm going to get arrested.
Well, no, you know? keep in mind, Mick, that the National Guard can move around. They're mobilized by governors. But regular Army, federal troops, are not supposed to be conducting operations in the contiguous 48. Now,
that's
get
right.
This. You just cross over the border a little bit north up into Canada. I've had callers call me from there and say that their American military are stationed in their towns. And these are fully equipped. She says they're fit, you know, like they're big and muscular. They don't talk to anybody. They don't interact with anybody. They're just present.
All I know, Brooks, is when I was a kid, you know, I was told, you know, the policeman's your friend. And the police I see around me now in my town are all, like, you know, heavily muscular in the upper body and a bit on the racist side, but I don't want to go there, but that's a fact. And I see a pattern forming, and it's not good. And, you know, and I know love is the answer, but that is not in the minds of the people in power, whether it be in the local, state, or federal level.
Well, I don't know about the ones that are in camo, but I do know about the ones that wear a tie, a little medal, and a badge. They're not law enforcement anymore. They're revenuers, okay? They're out there to collect money for the legal system. Now, I got to tell you, I did have an opportunity to speak to Indiana's finest the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of interesting, the situation, what he revealed to me. I'm got my big diesel truck, and I'm pulling a trailer behind me, and I'm on cruise control. And I admit, you know, maybe traffic was changing, and I was changing lanes, and I was talking on the phone. There's a possibility that I exceeded the speed limit a little, but I wasn't driving unsafely. Next thing I know, there's blue lights behind me, and I get pulled over, and he says, you were doing, I won't tell you what I was doing. But I said, gee, I really don't see how that's possible. I mean, I'm with traffic. I'm not really passing anybody. I'm just kind of, you know, staying safe, moving back and forth as time permits, because I really don't want to make a lot of driving maneuvers because I'm on the phone here. And I said, how did you pick up my speed? He said, I picked you up individually with a system that does not send out a signal, and it picks out an individual vehicle. So I didn't confuse you with anyone else, and I've been doing this for 23 years. I didn't think anything about it because the guy was really aggressive. So I signed his little admit to guilt, and I popped it in my glove box, and then I thought about it. Just a minute. What kind of receive-only system would he be using that would pick out a specific vehicle? Because I'm a technology guy, you know. I think about this stuff. Look, my truck doesn't put out any signals. I don't have a radar detector on it or anything. He couldn't have picked up my speed. And then I realized how he did it. It was the surveillance cameras along the side of the freeway. They have speed detectors in them. Every few miles, every quarter mile in some areas, you'll see these standalone surveillance cameras. The picture is, it looks a little bit like the NASCAR cameras. You know when you're watching the race and the guys are going around like 195 miles an hour, and you could read the numbers on the side of the cars, but unless he's your favorite driver, you don't know which one's which. So they got this little tag. It's an animated tag that attaches to the roof of the vehicle, and up at the top it says Earnhardt, 195 miles an hour, and it stays right on the car as it goes around the track.
What state were you in?
I was in Indiana.
Indiana.
These
NASCAR territory.
They're everywhere, Mick. These cameras are everywhere. And I got an open call. Anybody that's seen one of these cameras installed by a crew, anybody seen servicing one of these cameras, anybody seen one of these cameras go bad and have to be replaced, does anybody know where these cameras came from? There are thousands of them, and they're expensive.
People who are afraid of cameras, who think that the proliferation of cameras in the United States is going to be a problem, should go to London sometime and see what's happening in the streets of London. You can't walk a single square inch of London and not be looked at.
Well, that's a fact. What they say over there is, look,
I happen to be Irish American, so I know a little bit about that country, you know?
Yeah. I'm Scottish
myself.
I come
from a race of oppressed people, in other words, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Anything the Brits come up with, I'm not really happy about. But they have, retroactively, when there is a bomb set off, they'll go back and look at the photograph records, the video records, and they'll see everybody that went in through that door prior to that explosion, and they can trace every single one of those people back to their apartments when they left that morning. And that's how they go and arrest the bad guys. And that's how they prevent crime. And they do a really good job at it. So what they say over there is, hey, if you're not going to break the law, you got nothing to fear, right? Well, that's what they say in this country, too.
We have a little bit of time left. Can we go back to the thing that started all this controversy, really, Brooks, about 9/11? I mean, there's a book out by Jim Mars. I've read all of Jim Mars' books, and one of which is about 9/11. And for those people who are not familiar with the book, it basically says that it wasn't some guy in a cave in Africa, in Afghanistan, conducting an operation, you know, with a computer. It was the secret government of the United States along with the Mossad of Israel. Now, if that's the case, if that's just say for argument's sake that that's the case, and the point being that what was wanted in that operation was trying to get the United States people to have an anti-Arab or anti-Islamic, Islamophobic thing going there. They succeeded tremendously, and it kind of makes sense. I'm not saying I can prove it, but it just kind of makes sense. And starting from that point of view, everything that's happened from then up until now is... Israel has its fingerprints on a lot of things, whether you're talking about the flotilla to the attempted flotilla to help the Palestinians in the occupied territories, or I don't know. And again, it's not me. It's a lot of people feel the same way I do, but they don't speak out about it. The whole country of Canada is moving in, if you've seen any documentaries in free speech television, Democracy Now! And that sort of thing recently, you've seen that the Canadian government has a foreign minister who is adamantly pro-Israel, and anybody who attempts to help struggling peoples like Palestinians are put down. And somebody described Canada as just another consulate for Benjamin Netanyahu. It's getting out of hand. No one little country should have all that power. And maybe you want to comment on that. I don't know.
Well, you know, there's a general feeling out there, and I travel a lot, I meet a lot of people, I talk to a lot of people, and there's a general feeling out there that people are getting a little bit, they're getting a lot sick and tired of being governed by fear. Police are no longer public servants. They are feared. When a policeman shows up on the street, you know something's wrong. They're never there to help. They're always there. And by the way, it became so bad, their predatory practices on the American highway became so bad that the presence of a highway patrol vehicle actually caused fatalities. It actually caused people to crash. Mm-hmm. And it's undeniable. I mean, the statistics are really unbelievable. Thousands and thousands of people were being killed because there was so much fear when they see the blue lights of a cop car on the road.
And so I also don't want people to get the feeling that, like, I'm prejudiced in any one way, shape, or form, because, as I said, I'm an Irish-American. I know there's a lot of Irish cops in New York City, for instance. And if you remember the case of Eleanor Bumpers, there was a guy by the name of Sullivan involved. And after the fact, he didn't say, I'm sorry it happened, and if I had the chance to look, analyze the situation again, I wouldn't have fired, and blah, blah, blah. But he didn't say any of that. He said, I'm a cop, and I did what I had to do, and if I had to do it again, I'd do it again. You know, there was no remorse, no soul, no sympathy, no nothing coming from that police officer. And as an Irish-American, I was ashamed of him for saying that. You know what I'm saying? So it's not, I'm not sticking up for one race or another. It's that when I see a wrong, I say something about it. That's all.
And I'm the same way. And what we have is we have a nation that seems to be reverberating with a feeling of separation from our own government. We don't trust them.
They're fear-mongering.
Yeah, they're not fear-mongering. They're using fear as a tactic. And lots of nations have tried that. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Eventually, the people are going to get fed up with it, and they're going to rise up, and they're going to take control. And that's exactly the kind of situation that they are set up to deal with. And when I watch the financial meeting that they have, I think it's called the G8 meeting.
G20 or G8 or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
I watched the meeting in Canada, and I watched the citizens out there with bullhorns, and the mayor was out there, and they were talking. And the police marched forward with these plexiglass shields, beating their billy clubs on the shields like they were Roman soldiers, marching curb to curb down the street to push these people out of. And I don't know if in Canada they have
a two-step Nazi stuff.
Yeah. I don't know if they have the right to assemble in Canada like we do. But they marched.
There was a woman in her own backyard, Brooks, the other day who was taking a picture of a police officer abusing a citizen, you know, and the cops told her to put her camera away or else she'd be arrested. And she didn't put her camera away, and they arrested her in her own backyard.
How could they?
You know, Rodney Bumpers is not an isolated case. Rodney King is not an isolated case. It's a pattern that's forming, and people better really start wise up really quick, because
I guess they just didn't want to see that film make it to YouTube, which is exactly where it would have gone if I had taken it with my phone. It would have been on YouTube in 5 minutes. That's what we need to have. We need to have this vigilance. And we need to do this in a nonviolent way. If they're gonna perpetrate violence, I'll give you another example. I was traveling with somebody. We were in Spokane, Washington. We had arrived. It was a long flight. It was late at night. And this particular person's a smoker. I'm not. So, of course, the first thing we had to do was walk past baggage, go outside, and light a cigarette, right? So we're outside, and this person's trying to get the lighter to light, and the wind was up, and the lighter wasn't cooperating, and out stepped two TSA agents wearing guns. And they said, you can't light a cigarette here. And he said, what do you mean? I'm outside. I mean, you know, no. You're within 25 feet of the doorway. You have to go across the street to light that cigarette. And he said, well, wait a minute. It's 30 degrees out here. The wind's blowing. Look, I got to have a cigarette here. If you don't cross that street, I'm going to arrest you. And he said, what do you mean you're going to arrest me? I'm not smoking. No, but you're holding the cigarette, and you're holding the lighter, and you have the intent to light that cigarette. And if you don't cross the street, I'm going to take you in. And this person said, but I'm not smoking. And the person said, it doesn't matter. I'll say in my report that you were smoking. Now get across the street or put that cigarette away. I am a complete pacifist. But I was almost in a situation where I had to throw a TSA agent through a window. I don't like that, Mick. I don't want to be in that position. What's going on?
I find myself. I have a degree. I have various degrees, and when I'm not teaching, from September to May, I worked in various jobs, driving taxis and this, that, and the other thing during the summer. And I'm dealing with people who are, you know, not as fortunate as I am educationally, and it's difficult sometimes. But you try to deal with level and mentality that just, it's hard getting through to people that look.
Yeah, but
just
look,
because
look,
I'm
Mick, hold on just for a second. Just
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mick.
Yeah.
Do a flashback. Let's go back to 1941. Intelligent, well-educated, well-documented people with a proud history put their heads down and marched into ovens because of a few law enforcement officers that ruled over them by intimidation and fear. Yeah. Now, am I saying that today's cops are like Nazi stormtroopers?
No. But keep in mind that 1941 was also the year that FDR and Marshall and a few other people, I don't know how many other people, knew that Pearl Harbor was about to happen, didn't do or say anything about it, and let it happen. We know about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution situation, and that's what precipitated our entry into Vietnam. These are all black operations, and 9/11 is no different. So people need to smarten up. You know, the fascism is on the right. What's happening in this country now is what happened in Germany in the 30s and the 40s. And they need to know that the grandfather of George Bush, too, was one of the primary backers of National Socialism and Hitler in Germany. Senator from Connecticut. What's his name? I forget his first name, Bush. But, you know, these are things, and yet his grandson was president. His son and his grandson were presidents of the United States, one of the leading fascists in the world, you know. Henry Kissinger, Rockefeller, these were all part of the Illuminati, the powers that be, the Bilderberger group, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. I don't have time to spew out all of my...
Well, there's no
theories,
question.
But you know what I'm talking about.
There's no question that from the time, you know, just before Clinton was elected, you know, Bush won, served one term and was out. About around that time, all public radio stations, not the broadcasters, but the stations themselves, were pulled under the ownership of two or three companies. Mm-hmm. Anything that ran on the radio was overseen by these three or less than half a dozen owners. Now there, I think there's only two main owners, a few independent radio stations, but they can't afford to compete against these stations that are bringing in national advertising accounts. Now, in addition to that, not only that, but the Education Edge and Goals 2000 programs were implemented in the public schools. This set up national testing. It set up rewrites of history books, of sociology books, everything to bring the total message in line with what the government wants you to learn and wants you to be proficient with, not the truth. Some of us lived through that history, and we know it happened a different way. One day we're going to die off. There won't be anybody alive to tell a different story. And the victors will have rewritten history again. And if we
don't...
You know,
the thing that kills me, Brooks, is... I mentioned the Kissingers and the Rockefellers of the world. But what about you know, the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney. The man has had, what, 5 or 6 heart operations? He's got 1 foot in the grave, and yet it seems that he's doing his best to screw as many people as he possibly can before he's finally put under. And I just don't understand that mindset. Why? Why?
Well, I don't either. That's a question that every listener to this program tonight, every archive listener, needs to answer for themselves. Because once you understand the answer to that, you understand what your role is. And the next time a police officer approaches you and you open your mouth to defend yourself and you feel as though one more word out of your mouth and you're going to be arrested, you'll know what it feels like. You'll know what it feels like. He's armed, he has a judge behind him, and you don't. And that's what it feels like.
You're a gentleman and a scholar, and I hope your listenership is skyrocketing as well it should.
Well, I appreciate it so much. One day we'll figure out how to monetize it. Right now it's a hobby. I pay for it out of my pocket, and I love every moment of it.
I know. I used to do radio myself a number of years ago. I did Irish programming.
Excellent.
WBAI in New York for about 20 years. I was the original programmer on the Irish question. I used to have
a strong Scottish accent when I was very young.
So we're both
Celts, out.
Brooks, you know? And,
you got it, mate.
And I think, I think Ireland was doing fine until St. Patrick got there. As you probably know.
All right. All right. Thanks so much for the call, Mick. I'm going to wrap things up.
All right. All the best. Bye-bye.
All right. Another episode, another great 3 hours. Listen, internet radio is a little different than broadcast radio. We could say what we want. We could cover the subjects that we want. If you don't like it, you could just switch to another station. Right now, this is free and open media. It is the ultimate in free press. We live or we die by whether or not we can gain a listener audience. Here at X Squared Radio, we try to tell the positive message. We try to alert people to things that are going on, empower you so that you can do something about it. We're sorry that Jim Stone didn't come on tonight. I hope that I represented his material with honor and gave him enough credit. It's jimstonefreelance.com if you want to check out the story for yourself. We encourage you to do so. And we also encourage you to spread the message, the presence of this radio program far and wide. Here at the BBS Radio Network, there are hundreds of hosts working tirelessly to bring you the best in broadcasting from their opinion. And there are all kinds of things to choose from on this network. It is the number one internet radio network on the web anywhere in the world. We can say that definitively, and the quality just keeps getting better and better. And by the way, X Squared Radio is the number one program on that network, and it's because of you, the listener. We appreciate it so much. Keep spreading it far and wide. We'll do everything in our power to keep it free and open, no charge to anyone that wants to listen to this program. The archives are a very small nominal fee of $2.50 a month. Unless you want to buy a year's worth of access, which it could take you over a year to listen to over 1,000 hours of content, it's $20 a year. Come on, that's less than the price of a cup of coffee a month. You can do it. xsquaredradio.com. Thank you so much for being part of the program tonight. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.